Ah, mmm. The first taste of rare bourbon you finally got your hands on. That's nice. At Caskers.com, we make this experience easy. Caskers is a one-stop spirit curator with an impressive selection of exclusive, sought-after, rare, and household names in the realm of premium spirits and champagne. Discover the top flavors of the year now by going to Caskers.com and using code WELCOME10 for $10 off your first purchase. Get $10 off your first purchase with code WELCOME10 at Caskers.com.
It's Tuesday, March 5th, 2024. From Peachfish Productions, it's The Gist. I'm Mike Pesca. The Union of the New York Times announced today that the paper was targeting MENA journalists as part of a leak investigation. Wait, what do I mean? MENA investigation? MENA stands for Middle Eastern and North African. And really an ethnically based investigation by a paper. There's nothing MENA. But at issue is an edition or a scrapped edition of the podcast The Daily. Apparently there, the staff had considered turning the big New York Times front page story about the rape of Israeli women on October 7th into a podcast. What happened next was that staffers of The Daily, or maybe staffers of the New York Times, who were familiar with some of the discussions at The Daily, leaked this information to the online leftist magazine The Intercept. And Ryan Grimm of The Intercept wrote up a story which claimed that the New York Times podcast was spiking the New York Times other journalism because it couldn't confirm it. The paper disputed that. Yesterday, or a couple of days ago, The Intercept published its first big story trying to poke holes in the New York Times story. We discussed that a bit yesterday. I laid out why I don't think it got there. Not in substance, but there is a great destabilization within the shop that is The Daily if you have people affiliated or perhaps within that shop leaking to outsiders complaining about journalistic choices. So the Times sought to find out who brought the internal editorial decisions public in a way designed to be most damaging to the newspaper. I guess some of those being investigated are in the MENA category. Ryan Grimm tweeting today, it's 2024 and the New York Times is trying to find our sources by targeting its Arab and Muslim journalists for suspicion. If they let their bigotry guide their investigation, they're just going to harass a bunch of innocent journalists. That's true if they were guided purely by bigotry, but if they allow their suspicions to guide their investigation, they will inevitably be asking questions of Arab and Muslim staffers. You can't win, which is what the New York Times Guild, their union, is banking on. The paper officially denies racial profiling, of course. The Times also stands by their reporting on this incident or these incidents of rapes, and they say that no segment of The Daily was canceled over editorial concerns. I will add that a few minutes after yesterday's Gist, after we published, The Intercept posted another article about the story of rapes in Israel and the Times reporting on it. The headline, Israel's War on Gaza, Kibbutz Be'eri rejects story in New York Times October 7th expose, they were not sexually abused. This does comport with the findings of the United Nations, which I discussed yesterday. I said that specifically, that the United Nations found that two of the allegations could not only not be confirmed, but they said that they didn't happen. But I didn't know that the Intercept was publishing this story because, as I said, it predated the Gist's posting, and therefore I just wanted to bring it to your attention. If it's right, it shows that there was an eyewitness account in the Times original story that was inaccurate. As I said before, the Times stands by the overall accuracy of their story, which is, in a nutshell, many rapes by terrorists against Israeli women on October 7th. We will get into that in the future on the Gist. I will just point out that The Intercept doesn't seem to be disputing that there were many rapes by terrorists against Israeli women. The crux of their dispute hinges on the word or concept of those rapes being systemic or systematic. The Intercept not necessarily disputing so much as giving the appearance of disputation. That will be tomorrow on the show as we follow this story. On our show today, Kyrsten Sinema, literally strong independent woman, won't seek re-election to the Senate, and this during Women's History Month. We'll check in on all the public lamentations around this development and find that there are none. But first, we did talk to The New Yorker's Jonathan Blitzer yesterday about the Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas and his impeachment by the House of Representatives, and also the larger Biden administration policies on immigration at the southern border. Blitzer is the author of The Trials of Alejandro Mayorkas. He's also out with a new book, Everyone Who Is Gone Is Here, The United States, Central America, and the Making of a Crisis. And today, we continue our conversation and talk about, are there any new ideas in this space? Jonathan Blitzer up next. Winter, where I'm from, is not over. But I look at the bright side. I call it soup season. And I try to get all the ingredients, source the ingredients, master my recipe. And as I'm doing that, getting cash back on the purchases I make with Ibotta. Ibotta is the free app that gives you the most cash back every time you shop on hundreds of items, from groceries, spices, and stock, to beauty supplies, to toys. You beat inflation no matter what you're purchasing. Your average Ibotta user earns $145 a year. Don't you want $145 a year? You know what it costs you? It costs you nothing to use the app, Ibotta. Get in on that. Other apps give you points that don't amount to much. With Ibotta, you just add your offers in the app, you upload your receipt, and then you get real cash that you can cash out to your bank account or PayPal or gift cards. Join the over 50 million savers and earn cash back every time you shop from over 2,700 brands and retailers, including Lowe's, Macy's, Sephora, Best Buy, and more. Right now, Ibotta is offering our listeners $5, wow, just for trying Ibotta by using the code THEGIST when you register. This is free money upon free money. Go to the App Store or Google Play, download the free Ibotta app to start earning cash back, and use the code THEGIST. That's Ibotta in the Google Play or App Store, and use the code THEGIST. It will help you. It will help the show. And the soup you might make can help you, you know, clear up those block sinuses. This episode is brought to you by the Jordan Harbinger Show. You've heard me talk about the Jordan Harbinger Show because it's one of my favorites. He does in-depth interviews with some of the world's most fascinating minds. I can name a few: Barbara Boxer, Anderson Cooper, Michael McFaul, the Ukraine or Russia ambassador talking about Ukraine. One I recently listened to was Stanley McChrystal, the general, the former general. And he told an interesting story about revering Robert E. Lee. But then, after having a portrait of him for 40 years, he's a 63-year-old man, throwing it in the trash. Because his wife says, you know, what that picture and that man means to you, it doesn't mean to other people, and you have to understand that. And then in the interview, they got around to the point where McChrystal talked about that interview in Rolling Stone magazine that pretty much ended his career, where got to the desk of Barack Obama, and it had McChrystal saying unflattering things about the war effort, and just how he talked to his wife and how they decided not to be bitter and not to wallow in it. He could have taken some shots at the process, the reporter, or the president at that point, but he didn't. It was just an overall good interview. It was facilitated by Jordan's excellent interview style. Whether Jordan is conducting an interview or giving advice to a listener, you will find something useful that can apply to your own life in every single episode of the Jordan Harbinger Show. That could mean learning how to ask for advice the right way, or discovering a little mindset tweak that changes how you see the world. Search for the Jordan Harbinger Show. That's H-A-R, like the first three letters, and hard, B-I-N-G-E, as in how you'll want to catch up on all the episodes on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. In the February 23rd issue, maybe February 17th online, of The New Yorker, Jonathan Blitzer wrote about not just Alejandro Mayorkas, the Secretary of Homeland Security, but what he represents on the immigration question as a whole. The article was titled, The Trials of Alejandro Mayorkas. I started by asking about the politics of immigration on the left and even with the 2020 presidential campaign. There is a constituency supporting Biden, or just a large constituency among Democrats that do operate as something like the worst Republican fever dreams endorsing open borders. And it should be said, in the 2020 campaign, Biden, even though he spoke about asylum and dealing with the border, the migrants in a humanitarian way, and that came across, he did separate himself from the other Democrats in, you know, just wanting to enforce the law, for instance, and actually saying that and endorsing that on the stump. So my point is that, so Mayorkas, in dealing with the left, that's no small thing, because the left, or the people who are most in favor of more immigration, did put a lot of pressure on Biden. And you have this scene in your story where he's meeting with a group of immigration lawyers, and he points out that if we go through, was it the parole system? But if all the steps are taken and there is someone doesn't qualify for asylum, what is the thing that we have to do? And the answer is to, we have to remove them from the country. And none of these lawyers would admit that, right?
Yeah, I mean, it shows, that's an interesting scene because I you know, everyone feels very strongly about what that scene reveals. From Mayorkas' standpoint, he was presenting himself in front of a group of advocates at a very complicated political moment in 2022, in the spring of 2022, and saying, look, put yourself in my position. Let's imagine a world in which the system does work to some degree, that we can guarantee that asylum seekers have legal representation, which is, it should be said, not a guarantee for any asylum seeker. That does not exist. The right to counsel does not exist in the immigration space. So he's trying to kind of control for all of these different variables to lead the advocates in the room to this overwhelming question of, okay, if someone has exhausted the full legal process of being able to lodge an asylum claim with representation, have that asylum claim be rejected, appeal that asylum claim, lose the appeal, what are we supposed to do? And so from his perspective, the inability of advocates to say, well, look, there is a condition under which we have to agree, as unsavory and upsetting as it is, that this merits someone's removal. And of course, the advocates in the room didn't say anything. If you look at it from the other side, the way the advocates feel is, you know, why do you need this validation from us? What do you want from us? We're advocates. Our view is we're going to fight for our clients. Our clients face these impossible odds in the asylum system. You know, we're not going to give you, if you're coming to us for validation or cover, that's not our job. And I have to say, I am sympathetic to that tension in general. I mean, it's a complicated moment. But I think what's interesting is, and this is where it dovetails with our conversation about failed immigration reform efforts. You know, in the past, the general logic on the Democratic side was, you know, we have a goal in mind, and that goal is the legalization of the 11 plus million undocumented people living in the United States. And if it means being harsher at the border, that's a cost we should be willing to incur in order to finally give relief and stability to, you know, 11 million people who deserve some sort of protection. When that was, you know, finally removed from the political conversation, and I would say the moment that that kind of died was with the death of the reform bill in 2013, 2014, the center of gravity really shifted, and the border really became front and center, the kind of fight for advocates in the immigration space. And there, the solutions are a lot more complicated. How you fix the asylum system, how you deal with conditions in the wider region in Latin America and in the world that drive people to come. And there, you're on a collision course between advocates whose view of this is that they think of the advocacy in terms of individual clients seeking asylum, and the government, which sees basically a system that it doesn't feel is manageable. They see, you know, large percentages of people seeking asylum who don't get asylum. How do you make the system work when the vast majority of people applying don't have legitimate asylum claims and aren't going to win? How do we split the difference? And I basically think we've been in that loop. I mean, we were in that loop at the end of the Obama years, frankly. It just got interrupted by Trump. But that conversation continues.
And I do understand meeting with a bunch of advocates. And it's like if you're meeting with defense attorneys and you say, well, if we have a prosecution that violates no laws and violates no civil rights, and on the books it says you go to jail for a life sentence if you commit this murder, and we absolutely prove it, shouldn't he go to jail for a life sentence? I could understand the lawyers, the defense lawyers saying, hey, that's not our job to validate. Fine. But my question is actually, and then as you articulated what his point with that was, why did he want you to be there and to know that? that, or it wasn't one of these things where you dug it out and he had to admit, yeah, that happened. He was eager to show you that this was the dynamic going on. To me, it's, well, you tell me, but to me, it seemed like he was saying something along the lines of, see what I'm dealing with?
Yeah, that's interesting. You know, I will say, for what it's worth, I didn't just get that scene from him. And in fact, a lot of people brought it up with me, including advocates, yeah, which is just to say, you know, when you, like, as a reporter are hearing this anecdote surface from so many people, you begin to understand, okay, this is clearly a moment that was important to a number of people for a number of different reasons. So, you know, it was sort of on the table, not just because he was sort of pointing me in the direction of this moment, but because so many people were, and ironically, everyone was pointing to me to this moment with kind of a different agenda in mind in terms of, like, trying to persuade me of a different fundamental thing. But you're right. I mean, his view of this is, look how impossible my position is, you know? And I think it's interesting to see, there's almost something that strikes me as quaint about holding up the left as the problem now, because the advocacy community on the left just does not have the influence it used to. Even coming into the administration, there was evidence of the influence of advocates in the earliest days of the Biden administration, and that really dissipated fast. The moment that Biden's first political crisis in office became the southern border, which of course for me was utterly predictable, for many people was utterly predictable, but nevertheless seemed to rock the White House and really put it into a kind of tailspin and a prolonged posture of defensiveness, the kind of pressure point moved much more quickly than anyone expected to center right.
And so, but they don't really have the power either. I mean, we saw a center right coalition of people work together with some Democrats to come up with this comprehensive bill, and it just got blown up because Donald Trump thought it would be a bad election issue. So no one really has the power. Everyone just has access to the brakes.
That's true. That has become the case. But
if I could also ask you, if you were Jim Lankford, I'm trying to take a Republican who's not, you know, frothing at the mouth, or a demagogue on this, someone who wants to solve this, wouldn't you point to that dynamic, that meeting with Mayorkas and the lawyers, and the fact that Mayorkas is essentially saying, see what I have to deal with? And wouldn't you say, well, this is why we can't vote for Democrats? Like, if you, at least if you vote for Republicans or have Republicans in charge of this issue, they don't have to listen to that constituency that literally does want, quote unquote, quote, open borders.
Yeah, I don't see the anecdote in exactly that light. I don't think the anecdote is that significant in that way, in terms of, like, Republicans seeing a moment like that and extrapolating from there that, you know, Democrats just aren't people we can kind of deal with in negotiations. It's important to say the full context around that moment in the piece was, you know, a few months prior to that meeting with advocates, Mayorkas went to a bunch of Border Patrol outposts out west in Yuma and Laredo, and in El Paso, and basically had to face up to a staff of disgruntled Border Patrol agents who, it really needs to be said, are insubordinate in the extreme in that job, and yeah, have done actual things operationally to try to sabotage the broader department. Significant things. So I'm talking about, it's just as an example, in the summer of 2021, a group of Border Patrol agents decided essentially that the numbers were high, they didn't like it, and they would refuse to issue what are called notices to appear, a kind of a form of paperwork that basically set people up to have an appointment with ICE, an eventual appearance before a judge. And they just kind of waved people through as a way of kind of spiking the ball in the face of the broader department. And that caused real chaos. That meant, you know, 1,000 people a day were admitted into the United States by Border Patrol, without any obvious set of steps they could go through to begin to get their status in order. So, like, you know, he's shuttling between those elements inside his own department and people who he hoped would be more sympathetic to him outside it, who are nevertheless kind of pursuing their own agenda. So that's kind of how I see the broader context.
Could I just ask you, why is that? Why are Border Patrol agents insubordinate, the enforcement arm of a cabinet position, in a way that, say, FBI agents aren't as it comes to the Department of Justice? Or we could think of other enforcement arms of different agencies. Is it about the where they're recruited from, the realities of the job? What do you think that is?
It's a good question. Couple things. One, the quality of agent is, I think, it's uncomfortable to say, but is, like, a lot lower than it is, say, at the FBI or the U.S. Marshal Service.
Well, okay, it might be right. I mean, that's that's defensible. You know, here are the number of years to qualify for the job. Here's the average GPA, let's say, of the college graduate who gets the job. Okay.
I think there's that. There's the institutional culture of that agency, which is in far-flung remote places along the border, feeling very much resentful of the idea that there are dictates from Washington that they have to carry out when no one in Washington understands the reality of their job. That's two. Three, they have a really hard job. I mean, it has to be said. I mean, these guys basically are dealing with like extreme circumstances every day. There's a lot of burnout. There's a relatively high suicide rate in the ranks of Border Patrol. A lot of them got hit very hard by COVID. It should also be said that there was a relatively high rate of refusal to vaccinate among Border Patrol agents. But the point being, like, they're really bearing the brunt of a lot of stress to the system. And to their minds, and they're not wrong in thinking this, you know, Washington lawmakers continue to fail to deal with this issue in a bigger way. And I think the Border Patrol agents understandably feel like, okay, the weight of all this is on our shoulders all the time. Then there's the fact that this issue is just hopelessly politicized and has always been, more so than most other issues in America in terms of law enforcement. There's the increasing fact of a partisan tilt to how this division of law enforcement regards its job. You know, the Border Patrol Union, for the very first time, endorsed a presidential candidate in 2016. It was Trump. So there was this element always, well before Biden, since well before Trump, of Border Patrol agents who felt like Democrats were soft, Republicans were only a little bit better. So they kind of felt vindicated to finally hear someone like Donald Trump on the campaign trail talk about, you know, the ravages at the border and all of that. So I think there are a lot of things, and it's complicated on a kind of a hierarchical level. You know, what do you do? You're at the very top of this department. It's an enormous federal department, 260,000 employees in DHS, you know, two dozen agencies. And, you know, we're only talking about immigration enforcement bodies inside DHS. There are, you know, the Coast Guard, FEMA, cybersecurity. I mean, there's a whole range of agents that the secretary is dealing with. And so it's complicated too to, you know, to create a sort of top-down dynamic inside the Border Patrol, and efforts to have often backfired because there's a feeling of real resentment and a real skepticism of people kind of from outside the agency, you know, telling agents how to do their jobs. So there's a kind of a chip on their shoulder that any leader of the department has to deal with. It's a real mess. And there have been efforts over the years to bring accountability to that agency, and those efforts have often failed and only bred more resentment. So it's kind of a vicious circle. So that's a complicated element in all of this.
The common message of Democrats who come into office or talk about the border issue is to emphasize humanity. And I do believe that Joe Biden firmly wants to treat people humanely. And the common message of most Republicans, certainly Trump Republicans, are to, let's say, de-emphasize humanity, to be very fair, talk about the humanity of Americans as victims, but they eschew that as the way to judge the issue. Do you think that, and I understand why politically you'd want to talk about the inhumanity of Republicans if you were a Democrat, because then if that's what the conversation's about, you know, it's at least perceived to be, it's probably more of a winning issue for you than what's really going on at the border. But do you see fundamentally that there is a tension between how to treat people humanely, kids in cages, not separating family, that it's either that or to have fewer people come to the border? Or is that really not what's going on?
I'm really glad you asked that question. There are two big thoughts, you know, broad thoughts I have on that. The first is the way I've come to regard the difference between Democrats and Republicans on immigration enforcement issues, and particularly at the border, is to sort of see the range of policy options on a continuum. And, you know, it's sort of like to every administration that comes into office, there's a familiar arsenal of tools that they have at their disposal that, you know, range the farther you get on the continuum toward increasingly harsh outcomes. Example, harshest outcome imaginable, which we saw in 2018 during the Trump administration, was family separation. You know, that it wasn't like the Trump administration invented that idea. You know, operators have had to kind of come up with brainstorms about ways of disincentivizing people to travel to the southern border for years and years. And this was always a point that came up, but that was always written off as simply too cruel. And what you see in the Trump administration is they say, no, we'll do this, fine. And I think there are other things, to give another example, and I think that's an example that's much more interesting in some ways, is this policy called Remain in Mexico, or the Migrant Protection Protocols, which was basically developed during the Trump era to shunt asylum seekers into northern Mexico. It eventually led to 70,000 asylum seekers, primarily from Central America, waiting in northern Mexico in immiserated conditions, in kind of like makeshift refugee camps, where they were subjected to all kinds of violence and brutalization at the hands of organized crime, while their immigration cases inched through the asylum process in the United States. So the actual execution of that idea by Trump was inhumane, to use the word that, you began this question with, and really overwhelming. And a lot of journalists went and documented just the human fallout of this, people being abducted, extorted, kidnapped, brutalized, all of that stuff. That idea itself first came up under a Democratic president. And the incarnation that, I mean, it never got so far along in conversation to actually materialize, but the imagined outcome of that wasn't what we saw with Trump, but a more concerted effort to protect asylum seekers in northern Mexico with the help of UN agencies, international cooperation, you know, measures being taken to make sure there was security, food, access to healthcare, while people waited for their asylum systems or their asylum cases to move through the system. So the reason I'm saying this is, you know, here is the same idea that had two different possible incarnations. Mm-hmm. And both are basically predicated on the fact that there is really a conundrum for how to deal with large numbers of people showing up at the southern border seeking asylum. It is an institutional and operational strain. And so I do think on the whole, certainly the Trump administration was willing to go far, far to the right of anything that previous administrations had considered, and to do it with blatant disregard for the human fallout. I do want to say an important point in all of this that I think gets lost when you kind of boil this down to the binary of Democrats want to be more humane, Republicans want to be less humane, is that a lot of these harsher approaches are somehow assumed to be more effective.
Right. That was my question. In the continuum from kindness to cruelty, when you get to the cruelty end of the continuum, are you actually realizing the trade-off? Okay, it's cruel, but you are getting fewer border crossings.
Well, and I don't think, and that's the thing. I mean, I don't think the evidence supports that the harsher you are, the better outcomes you get in terms of reducing numbers. And you know, you have to take my word for that. Look at that family separation policy. I mean, that was the most horrific thing I'd ever seen in this space in my life. And really, I think it's fair to say a low point for this country in recent history. Within a year, the numbers of asylum seekers showing up the southern border reached unprecedented heights. So, you know, people who are desperate are going to continue to travel to the southern border in search of protection and opportunity. Just, you know, kind of random harshness at the border does not have a meaningful impact on decisions that people are making when they're fleeing for their lives. That's not to say that a more orderly, enforcement-minded approach at the border isn't necessary to some degree and doesn't have consequences. It does, but you have to pair that with, from a kind of policy standpoint, you have to pair that with opportunities for people to come in a more orderly, legal way. It can't just be deterrence. Deterrence on its own does not work. We've seen it year after year, decade after decade. But if there is a more kind of concerted, wider ranging approach that actually does give people a lifeline through it all, I think then you could begin to contemplate, you know, whether or not this might be successful as a policy vision. But we've never even come close to that because the politics forbid it.
Jonathan Blitzer is a staff writer at The New Yorker. He is also the author of the new book, Everyone Who Is Gone Is Here, The United States, Central America, and the Making of a Crisis. He profiles Alejandro Mayorkas in the February 26th edition. Thank you so much, Jonathan.
Thanks so much for having me.
And now the spiel. United States Senator Kyrsten Sinema had an announcement today concerning her no longer being U.S. Senator Kyrsten Sinema.
The only political victories that matter these days are symbolic. Attacking your opponents on cable news or social media. Compromise is a dirty word. We've arrived at that crossroad, and we chose anger and division. I believe in my approach, but it's not what America wants right now. I love Arizona, and I am so proud of what we've delivered. Because I choose civility, understanding, listening, working together to get stuff done, I will leave the Senate at the end of this year.
Yeah, none of that's actually true, really, when you really examine it. Even the part about Americans not wanting civility, they actually do want civility. Though the protesters who followed Sinema into the bathroom to yell at her, they don't want civility. And while that group succeeded, especially with this announcement, in forcing her out of office, it's not because she is the paragon of bipartisanship. Oh, she is bipartisan, but that's not why so many dislike her. I think it has more to do with, well, we could say sex. And personal style, but also her opacity in how she dealt with the public, her constituents, and the issues. Sinema's theory of politics, or the specific politics of her being the 50th vote after Joe Manchin was the 50th vote in the Senate, I think the theory was flawed. I also always thought that I basically understood Kyrsten Sinema more than others did because so many people, partisans, were just incentivized to hate her from the right for her stance as a bisexual woman who flouts convention, from the left because she was the most conservative member of Congress and then the Senate. I read her book. I understood her life story. She was for years an activist and pretty far left in the Arizona State House. And she found, she reports, she found herself banging her head against the wall. That stance wasn't getting anything done, so she moderated while in office. And her time in the House of Representatives was a testament on how to do this skillfully. She was regularly ranked as the most conservative Democrat in Congress. That was just by her votes, not by anything she said. And when you combine that status with her personal style, which read to many, including many in the media, as more revolutionary than her politics actually were, it was a winning combination. But Arizonans at base are moderates. Sinema was the first Democrat who won a Senate seat there in 30 years. The image and policy of moderation was essential to that victory. But what she did was she positioned herself as more the hinge vote who needed oiling on so many, many proposals. And that is inherently an immoderate position. It wasn't in the interest of Arizonans to halt a massive Democratic spending bill in 2021 in order to keep open a hedge fund loophole. But that's one of the things Sinema fought for. She also opposed prescription drug price controls. In the end, she agreed, but she proposed a more forceful version of that measure. And this is despite the fact that lowering the prices of prescription drugs are basically the most popular policy in U.S. politics. Here's Emily Kirkland of Progress Arizona speaking to the Arizona Republic's Gaggle podcast back in October of 2021 when asked, what don't progressives such as yourself love about Kyrsten Sinema?
Increases in taxes on the wealthy and corporations that are hugely popular and really important. Her refusal to state what she does and doesn't like about the Build Back Better agenda makes it hard to know exactly what she's blocking. But, you know, there's childcare in that bill, policies to make healthcare premiums cheaper, efforts to invest in clean energy. It's a really popular agenda that she really does seem to be blocking big portions of. And that's before we even touch on path to citizenship for Dreamers and essential workers, voting rights, LGBTQ rights, workers' rights. I mean, there's just a lot of issues.
These stances did seem to misread the electorate, not the public who pays attention to politics, not just Democrats, but the electorate. Sinema made it difficult to read her and her policy desires. Often I would hear, okay, Joe Manchin's a swing vote. The White House has to placate or deal with Joe Manchin. But everyone understood where Joe Manchin was coming from, i.e. West Virginia. Joe Manchin is just not interested in controlling greenhouse gas emissions. But Sinema was pro-environment, but just generally less open to social spending than the average Democrat, even the average conservative Democrat. Her battles became a little bit inscrutable and I think ill-advised. She drew tremendous flack from the left and left the Democratic Party after she realized there was no place in it for her. And now she leaves the Senate. She no doubt feels burned by all the time she put into the abandoned Senate border bill. She was as prominent a voice in that as James Lankford, though he, as a Republican, took a lot more risk. Sinema also struggled in fundraising and her approval ratings. Politically, neither Republicans nor Democrats nor Arizonans, by Sinema's own assessment, will be sorry to see her go. I've also taken note of all the glee I've been hearing over her departure. This glee comes from many of the same quarters that champion free market feminism and Futurist Female Sparkle stickers. It's de rigueur to loathe Kyrsten Sinema, who is bisexual identifying, but without trying to make that a particularly big deal. Sinema is not a Democrat. She's not a Republican. She ran not just marathons, but Ironman triathlons. This all makes her literally a strong, independent woman. And yet, she will not be missed. I'm fascinated to see if she writes a memoir. I'm fascinated to see if anyone in the national media grapples with their initial misassessment of her as a refreshing, mavericky progressive, mostly because she is a bisexual and she dresses with, shall we say, flair. And if stolen election fabulist Carrie Lake actually beats Arizona Democrat Ruben Gallego for Sinema's Senate seat, I wonder if anyone then will admit to missing Kyrsten Sinema. Carrie Lake's comportment might just make that all a moot point. In short, I do await the Kyrsten Sinema memoir, and I also am fascinated to see what hedge fund she lands at. And that's it for today's show. Corey Wara produces The Gist. Joel Patterson's the senior producer. They're the quaint Mallards. Michelle Pesca is in charge of special projects and quality control for Peachfish Productions. The Gist is presented in collaboration with Libsyn's AdvertiseCast. For advertising inquiries, go to advertisecast.com/thegist. Improve, G-Peru, do-Peru, and thanks for listening.